invite everybody. I am Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joyce.
And four things that we always have to say. It's through having a sponsor, being a member of a home group, practicing the steps, and asking God every day to direct my thoughts and actions. But I have not had a drink since July 9th, 1995, and I am very glad for that. So, I've been doing this a little while. So our stories just close in a general way of what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. And so hopefully I can cover all of that in a timely fashion. I grew up in the Midwest. You know, like Dylan said, the country I come from is called the Midwest. And if you've never been there and you somehow do go, you might think that it's a little different. Things are a little different west of the Mississippi. Of course, when I came to Virginia, things are really different. Suffolk is really different. But yeah, it is a little different in the Midwest. And I grew up on a farm, and I went to a one-room school for kindergarten. So if you watch Little House on the Prairie, that was it. We had the bucket with the dipper in it to get water, and the bathroom was outhouses outside, you know. And let me tell you, the winters in the Midwest can be cold, and to have to put on a coat and boots to trudge through the snow to go to the bathroom, it's pitiful. It's just pitiful. But anyway, it was still kind of a fun thing, you know, to have that school. So grew up on the farm, and I thought my life was really happy. My dad did the farming with his brother and their cousin, but he also worked as a carpenter. Kind of goes in the family. The guys are carpenters. So he did all of that, and my mother was at home until I was about 10 or 11. I mean, it was right around the time my grandmother across the road died, and I guess money was tight. If you don't know this, farmers reinvest the money from the sale of their crops into seeds for the next year. And when they sell the cattle in Chicago at the stockyard, the money they get is to buy new babies that they're going to bring to adulthood. And so, with three kids, and my grandmother was sick all the time, money was just a little scarce. And I think my mother felt that she needed to go to work. So my grandmother dies, my mother goes off to work, and leaves me at home at the tender age of 10 or 11 as the caregiver and the laundry. That was pitiful too. I'm not good with wringer washing machines, but I had to take care of my brother and sister who were younger, and I had to start doing the cooking and baking. And you know, I had been baking with my other grandmother since I was about 5. And she taught me all the intricacies of pie crust and cookies and noodles. And we'd hang the noodles on the backs of the chair, or we'd hang them outside on the railing porch, and then we'd have to cut them all. I mean, I was killing chickens when I was quite young. And yeah, that was fun. Drove the chicken down. I did all that stuff. But it was fun with her as a guide, you know, and a helper. But then all of a sudden, when I had to start doing it myself, it was not fun anymore, you know, to have to cook all the meals and to have to get my brother and sister ready for school and make sure that everybody ate and that we were out of the bus in the right time. It was just not fun anymore. And I felt like, I felt like my life was over. Now, because I was feeling so miserable and, you know, just, I guess I was just feeling sorry for myself, but I didn't know it at the time. So I had some friends that I had met through my music lessons. I played the accordion. And one of them lived in the city about 15 miles away, and she invited me over to her house, and so I went there. I guess it was summertime, we weren't in school, and the two of us had this brilliant idea. We're going to try and get drunk or high. Now, we didn't have drugs, of course. Where we get those? We didn't have that. We didn't even have cigarettes to feel good. But we found cooking sherry in the refrigerator. I would not recommend it as a way to get drunk, but we drank it, and it tasted really bad. They put salt in it, so I guess we were thirsty. But, you know, it kind of worked. So we had that experience, but it was the only thing that we could feel like doing that would be, I don't know, taking us out of ourselves. You know, we've got to get drunk. And I guess that just started me off. So, you know, back home, my dad drank beer all the time. He drank the good ones, you know, PBR, Falstaff, Schlitz, all of those things that they made in Wisconsin and, you know, bugged across the Mississippi. So none of them were palatable to me, okay? I did not like the taste of them. However, in a pinch, when he had a can of beer open, you know, guzzling down half of it, it was manageable. Or to take one from the six-pack and slink up the stairs and go to my room to drink it when I felt a little crazy. I could manage that. It was better in some ways to go to the neighbors, and I actually made the rhubarb wine. It's called Peistengel. I help them every summer make this stuff. You know, pick the rhubarb, wash it, depress it, and make the stuff, and then put it in the cellar. And so I was able to get a little of that once in a while. That stuff would just knock you, you know, you'd be on the floor. But but it also did not taste good, okay? So a couple of years later, I got a job in the hospital where my mother worked, and my aunt lived just a little ways away, and it was decided that when I was going there to work on Saturday and Sunday at the hospital, that I would stay overnight at her house, the aunt, so that I didn't have to drive back and forth. So, and that was fine with me. So the very, very first night that I'm there, they're going to a party. You want to come? Of course I want to come to the party. I've never been to an adult party. So off we go, and I was given a glass of Wild Irish Rose. And some of you know it. I didn't know it. You know, I did not know it. But I drank quite a bit of it, and never had it before. Never had it again. I was so sick. Oh my God. Next morning, you know, I could barely get myself up off the bed and drive the 2.5 miles to the hospital. It was really bad. So of course I never drank Wild Irish Rose again. I learned. But my aunt was she was always wanting to mix things up in her blender. And so over the next year or so, we mixed up Brandy Alexander's pink squirrels. Those were wonderful things. They had ice cream in them. Then we did the margaritas. I never had any of those kinds of alcohol before, but they tasted good. You know, who wouldn't want alcohol that's mixing with ice cream? The margaritas, those were tasty. So I was introduced through my aunt, who was only 9 years older than me. I was introduced to all this really fun stuff, you know. So anyway, I'm going to backtrack about a year, because I was going to dances near where I live and met a guy, and we went out on maybe one date, maybe two, and then he disappeared. He was out of high school already. I was still in. But I heard that he had gone into the Army, and you know, okay, so that's over. Well, I thought that. So. So one day his mother called me, and she was talking about, oh, he's going over to Germany, and he's going to be lonely, and maybe you can write letters to him, you know, when he's in the Army. So I start writing letters. She got me, you know, the address and all that. I start writing letters to him, and before the year is over, this guy that I'd gone on two dates with, we're married, okay, we're married. And, I still had one more year of high school, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I got to go over to Germany, and that was wonderful. You know what? Nobody checks your ID. There, I don't know if there's a drinking age in Germany. I never did find out. But I was drinking anything and everything. The beer, they delivered cases of beer to the apartment. Going out on Friday nights with the platoon. And I can remember this one guy. I don't know how I can remember his name. Captain Kokerhans. And he was buying shots of cognac. For the women, I was sitting with all these women, all the wives, and he was buying shots of cognac for us. And, you know, he was just saying, you know, up, you know, bottoms up. And so I started drinking cognac. It wasn't really great by itself, but somebody suggested mix it with Coke. So, you know, you have a little glass of Coke, pour out some of it, put the shot of cognac in it, and I found my drink, you know, for a year or two, I found my drink. I tried other stuff, you know, they had some really good wine, but unfortunately, it did one of two things. Either it made me sleepy, or else I felt sick to my stomach. So I didn't think wine was really the answer. So the cognac was great. It really did the trick. So, you know, came back to this country, and after you've been somewhere where you can drink all the time, it's really hard to come back to a place where the drinking age is 21. I wasn't even 20, but private parties were the way to go. So anyway, when I was living in that life for the next few years. I was still very young, and I did manage to go back to high school, finish at my high school where I'd gone before. I just had to go for one semester, and then I had the first child, and worked and had another child, those kinds of things. But all the time that I was doing all of these things, my life did not feel good to me. I was not happy, and when there was any kind of stress, which seemed to be a lot, you've got kids, and you've got my ex-husband was a drinker. I think alcoholic, but you know, I don't know. I've never done any tests on him, but with that kind of life, you know, where he was wanting to go off and be with friends a lot, it put a lot of responsibility on me. And, you know, I've been having responsibility for 9 or 10 years already, and I was just done with it. I do not want to be responsible anymore. I was just, you know, I had gotten married very, very young, and before that was taking care of the brother and sister. And I just felt like I never had those teenage years where you just go to school and go to parties and all that. Never had any of that. But fortunately, there were enough times when there would be parties, you know, and get together. And you know, I moved from Cognac to Calvert, and that was my savior for a number of years. and so any time that I could, you know, I was going usually with him, but we'd go to parties and I could drink. Over the years, I would I don't know how many years, I can't even think now how many years it was, things did not get better. And at one point, we decided to split up, and the kids were young, but we split up. And what happens when you have two alcoholics that are not sober, don't have a God in their life, don't get counseling even, they don't know how to live by themselves, and I certainly didn't. And so we got back together. You know, we got back together. Nothing was fixed. And now it kind of escalated. So the second half was much worse. In all that was going on, you know, as if I didn't have enough in my life, I went to college. And because I'm an alcoholic, for me to go to college while I'm taking my kids to the dentist and basketball practice and all of that other stuff, it just meant that I have to work harder and study later at night, which I did. And coffee, of course, really helped. But I went to college and I graduated with high honors. And I went and got a job, not in the field that I thought I was going to go into, but I used my biology degree and I got a job. And when things were really, really stressful, when I'm at college or after that when I'm working, there was always alcohol. I could just pick it up and feel better. I had stopped for a few years. I tried to stop. I really thought, until I came into this program, that I had not been drinking at all. My grandmother died, my other grandmother died, and because she was not drinking, she was an alcoholic evidently, that didn't drink, I thought, well, I can do this. And so I tried. But you know, I was telling my friend that things like the eggnog that I'd mix up, the cream, the eggs, and the rum. The rum yes. was a flavoring. It really wasn't alcohol. It was just a flavor. So, you know, you've got a big container, and you've got the cup or so of cream, and some sugar, and a couple of eggs. Fill it up the rest of the way with rum and mix it, and pour out a little cup every time I felt the need. So I didn't count that. And then for some reason I drank a lot of rum. The rum with the warm Dr. Pepper. If you ever remember those old Dr. Pepper commercials, they'd show it being cooked in a saucepan with the lemon slices floating. Never did the lemon slices. But rum and warm Dr. Pepper was a delightful beverage in the wintertime. So I made that quite a bit, you know. And I even made it and put it in one of those great big stainless steel thermoses for, I was having my family over for Thanksgiving. And I kept pouring glasses of it and drinking it, and my grandmother asked me, what is that? I said, oh, it was just hot Dr. Pepper. And she did not believe, she did not buy it. She was the alcoholic too. She did not buy it. I must have been crazy that day. But but it really helped, you know, when you've got the house filled with your relatives and you're cooking all this food and the goose or whatever we had, it was really helpful. So anyway, I tried to not drink, and I was just going out of my mind with everything. And so I had this job, and I went to a psychologist, and she was listening to me talking about what's going on, and she said, you know, you really have a lot of stress in your life. Maybe you should go to the doctor and get some pills to calm down. I said, absolutely not. You know, I don't do pills. I'm scared of pills, and I had never used street drugs. But I certainly didn't want prescription drugs. And she said, well, then why don't you just go get a bottle of wine and have a glass of wine at night? All right, I'll do that. So I went to the wine. And now, remember, wine put me to sleep or made me sick. But I found the perfect thing. They had this little container. It had four little bitsy bottles of this pink stuff. And so I got my nice Czech glass, wine glass out of the cupboard, and I chilled one out of the four bottles, one, all right? And so that night after the kids were in bed, I pour it in my beautiful little glass, and I sit down in front of Letterman and drink it, and it, you know, it calmed down, and I was able to sleep. I'll do this again tomorrow. So I did it again the next day, but by then, I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I'm not even able to enjoy this for very long because I want to go to sleep. So forget the wine, I'm just going to drink what I want. So now it was back to drinking on a daily basis. And I was really like that one actress, I don't know who she was, When a Man Loves a Woman, and she was hiding her bottles in the laundry room. And I did that. You know, I would go to the store and I would buy what I thought I would need for a day and hide it in the laundry room and then drink it at night when the coast was clear. And then the next day, you know, make sure that I got the bottles. There was a bottle deposit in Iowa for 5 cents or 10 cents. I'm crazy. Take the bottles back to the store and turn them in for a couple of nickels and then buy more. So it was a lot of work, you know, it was really a lot of work. But from the time that psychologist said you should try the glass of wine until I came into this program, a lot of things happened. I was going to be divorced. I took a job in New Jersey and My daughter was in college. My son was, I don't even remember where he was. He was not living at home. But I moved to New Jersey and had a job there. A lot had changed in my life, and of course I think that if I would not have been drinking, I probably would not have moved halfway across the country. But again, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So off I went, and I wasn't out there long. My mother helped drive my stuff with me in the truck, and my daughter's dog sitting in the seat between us, and I think that was the end of April, and I was drinking, and my mother took her to the airport and off she went back home, and I'd cry after work and sit there with, I was drinking. Remember, I didn't like my dad's beer. So Yingling, Bass Ale, Foster's, I was really fond of Foster's. So I would stop at the liquor store on my way home and I'd get something and sit at home and cry, and the boxes were still all over. Melissa was off at college yet, and it was just, it was pitiful. It's really pitiful. But that was the end of April, you know, that first 4th of July, I can remember being on a pleasure boat. I could get seasick on anything, you know, and I'm on a pleasure boat with a bar for 4th of July. We're supposed to be enjoying the fireworks over the ocean, and all I was doing was sitting there drinking, you know, one after the other. And of course I felt really lousy because I'm now moving on a boat plus alcohol. It's just not good. But a couple of days later, my daughter and I went down to the little I don't know what it was called, it's like a British pub, and the name will come to me eventually, but they had a sale on tap, and I drank a couple of them, and they did, like the British did, pints or something. They were pretty good sized drinks, and so I had two of those, and she had to drive us back home. She was not happy. right? She's not happy with me. And a couple of days later, she said something to me, you know, that when I started drinking again, this is her perception of it, things just got really bad between the two of us. And she thinks that I should stop drinking. No, it never occurred to me. But anyway, I thought, all right, well, I can do this. You know, she's going to go off to school in August. I can do it between July 9th and when she goes off to school. So that was my plan. But at some point in that summer, I joined a group for divorced and separated people. I thought, you know, I should do this. And listening to me talking at the small group, one of the members of this group thought that I should go to an AA meeting, that it might help me. I don't know what it was that I was saying or how I was saying, but obviously, you know, a fellow alcoholic can recognize one. And so it was suggested that I go to an AA. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic. You don't even have to be. Just go there. I think it'll be a good place for you. So I went to my first AA meeting, and it's on a Tuesday night. It's a speaker meeting. The first guy was talking, and they were both from the absolute edge of the country, out by Newark and Elizabeth and stuff. They were from out there. The first guy was talking about whatever, and I didn't recognize anything that he said as anything that was in my life, nothing. The second guy came up there, and seriously, he was not anything like me either. He was talking about jail and losing cars and losing wives and getting fired from jobs and drinking and passing out in the car halfway up in the front yard, and nothing like that had I ever done. But when he started talking about how he felt, you know, the misery and the need for alcohol, the only thing that would make the day better when everything was falling apart, that I understood. You know, I can remember my first days of moving to New Jersey, sitting there crying and drinking a beer. You know, that really, it really hit home what he was saying about that. So even though I had nothing in common with either of these speakers, I could certainly get the reasons for them thinking that they were alcoholics, but the problems that they had in their life, and certainly more than drinking. So suggested that I go to a meeting the next day, and there I started, you know, 7 days a week. About 2 weeks later, on a Sunday night, this young man said that when I'm talking to him, he doesn't really think that I'm understanding myself as being an alcoholic, and maybe having a sponsor would be a good idea, might help me. So I asked this woman to be my sponsor. I don't know how I picked her, because she had flowing hair, she wore a long dress, and she was barefoot. I never went barefoot anywhere. Could not. And here she was barefoot in a building. And yet I asked her to be my sponsor. And she was not in the program for many years, but she agreed to be my sponsor, and we were going to start working steps. And we never sat down and cracked open a big book. All right. First thing I had to do was step one. She gives me this workbook about step one, and you have to write all this stuff. So every Saturday morning, you'd find me in my little tiny kitchen, about the size of this table, sitting at my little tiny table and going through this workbook on step one. And the two of us never talked about it, but I think it must have helped me in some way, because she eventually had me working on step two. And, you know, this whole time she was saying, you have to start praying and asking God to keep you sober for the day. And so I didn't know anything about praying. I mean, I had gone to church. My dad took me to summer vacation Bible school when I was young so that he could drive 2 miles down the road instead of at the American Legion for an hour and a half. But I just never really, I didn't go to church every day, and I didn't know how to pray. So she told me to do this. She gave me the daily reflection, said to read that, and then ask God every day to keep you sober. And then before you go to bed, down on your knees again, and just thank God for keeping you sober. So I started doing that, okay, every day. Go to a meeting every day. She said, I need to have a home group. And I joined a group that met Monday, Thursday, and Saturday. And you know, when they saw me come in that first Thursday night, Saturday would be the next meeting, and they saw how ignorant I was about AA. Oh, you could be the coffee maker. So
yes.
Over the next 3 years, I probably made as much coffee as Juan Valdez. And the counter, okay, where it was served, it was a counter, like in the other building. And the coffee pots are this big, and I was thin at the time. And so I had to get I put the coffee pot up on the counter, the two of them, there was two of them, this gigantic thing, get a pitcher, fill them up from the sink, step on the steps, you'll pour the water in, get the water to the top and put the coffee and everything, turn on the coffee pots, go put the chairs out, drive down the street and get cookies and cream for setting out, come back. And, you know, I did that every Saturday night for 3 years. And I don't know, it kept me sober, kept me there. It kept me at that meeting, you know, because the coffee maker, you have to unlock the door, there was a code. And so I did that. And in that time period, that first sponsor had to go out to California because she was going to introduce her young daughter to her brother who lived in California, and she thought she needed to do that in case anything ever happened to her. So she had a she had a job that was completely on the computer, it was online, so she could work anywhere. And she said before she went, and I don't remember what step we had gotten up to, nine or so, I'm pretty sure we had gotten up to that step, but she said that she does not recommend me trying to call her and have her as my sponsor. She really thinks I need somebody that I can see once a week and to get a new sponsor. So off she goes to California, and I was looking around at the women that I had met, and I chose this one woman that she was very nice, and we had some nice conversations. We never did step work. We never never talked at a specific time or anything. And whenever I felt like talking to her, I'd just give her a call. I would see her at a meeting once a week. But she was just not, she was not an AA person like even my first sponsor had been. And it wasn't working. You know, I wasn't getting any better. I had gotten to a point after working especially after the fifth step, it was we did the fifth step on two consecutive Saturdays because I just could not get what she was saying. You know, all right, so you had all this going on, but what was your part? My part? No, this is all about this person. No, what was your part? So I had a hard time with this. I really had a hard time with step four. But you know, she got me through that after 6 or 8 hours. I was told that maybe I needed to have somebody that was a little bit more structured and that had more time to spend with me. Because Carol, she could tell that I was needing more. You know, I was having issues with my kids and just everything, work. So I got another sponsor, And she was somebody that I had met at the very beginning when I was first going to meetings. She had started a meeting on Monday nights, and it was really close to where I live, so I had switched over on Mondays to that meeting. And her and her husband moved back to Maine, where they had they used to live. And our friend Frank had passed away, and she had come down for the funeral. And so I just knew, I need somebody that is that's really strong in the step work and the practices of the program. So I asked her, and she said yes. And is it possible to drive up to Maine so that we can do the step work?
Sure.
So one Friday after work. Now let me tell you, I was when I came to New Jersey, I was working in a little pharmaceutical, but I had gone to college and had all of my teaching classes, so all I had to do was take some tests and get a teaching job. So that's what I did. And so here I was working in a high school as a teacher, getting up at 4:45 in the morning so that I could be at work early, because high schools always start early, and get off of work on a Friday afternoon at 3 and drove the 7 hours to Maine. And the following morning, we started on step one, and we did step work until it was time to do step four. She put me up in the spare bedroom at a little desk. All right, here's paper, pencils, and you're going to do your fourth step now, and sometime this afternoon we'll go over it. So I did that, and it was incredibly easy. The first time I did the fourth step, it was not easy. I had trouble with that fourth column, and I had never read page 62 with such need as what I had been doing for quite a while after that. So anyway, I sat down and I put down all the people and all of the problems that I had done with, those relationships, and then later on we sat outside. Her husband would not have cared if we'd sat right next to him and talked about it, but we sat outside. She had a fire pit going. This is Maine in June or July. It's freezing cold. So we sat out there and did that, and the next day we finished up. We did 6 and 7, and she sent me on my way with my list. And from that point on, we did a weekly phone call, and we'd spend an hour, hour and a half on the phone, and we got all of the list and the amends ready to go. And so I went off and did amends again, and it was so much easier the second time around, because of course the first time I thought everybody else was at fault, not me. But it was just so much easier, I think, because I had done, I had done all of that, and I had actually been working with a couple of women, and you start taking somebody that's new through the steps, and they struggle on step 3 or step 4, and you can explain it to them when you've done it twice, because my second time around was just so much easier. And so anyway, I did that. I went back up to Maine in September. I'm convinced that I went up there another time in between, but I don't know. But I did go in September. She had a day of sharing, and so I went up and spent another weekend with her, and she came down the following summer, and we went hiking and talked and stuff. I had seen her quite a few times, and it was just really good to have a sponsor that worked the steps out of the big book. She had a sponsor. We're in the like the Pacific Group kind of sponsorship line, and you know, jacket podium. Don't wear shorts or tank tops. Women, she never said anything about the men. She wasn't concerned about them, but for women, you never wear shorts or a tank top to a meeting. And I had to call her at a certain time on a certain day, and I still had that sponsor. She, about the time that we moved here to Virginia, she moved to Illinois to be next to her son and her grandson. And so every time now that I go out to Iowa to visit the family, I stop and visit her, and, you know, we have a good time. But I call her on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock in the morning because that's what she asked me to do. And even though she has a different time zone, she wakes up early, so she's already bright-eyed and awake. It's really good to have a sponsor that has taken me through the steps, but really understands me, so that the couple of times over all these years when I've done something stupid or I can't get past the problem, she knows. You know, she knows me. My sister, about 6 years ago, was diagnosed with lung cancer. She never smoked, but she was diagnosed with lung cancer. And a year later, it had gone to her brain and other parts of her body, and so she was now on these terrible drugs and chemo and everything. She's still alive, but my sponsor could tell by listening to me on the telephone that I was very scared my sister was going to die, of course, and she's got stage 4 cancer. Of course I'm afraid she's going to die. But also that I'm not facing it. I'm being busy in my house, you know, I'm cleaning house or baking stuff or, you know, whatever it is. Buster thanked me last night for taking cookies to his anniversary. Go figure. But you know, I was doing all of this stuff, and it was nice to be here by my daughter and the grandkids. But she said, I'm really not facing the fact that my sister is going to die. And you know, granted, she's kept alive longer than what they told her was possible when she first was diagnosed. Because, you know, they said maybe 3 years, 4 years, but, you know, she's still around. But Anne Marie said that she knows that I really am not facing this, and so I'm going to have to do a little bit more praying to get myself to accept that, yes, she's going to die. And, you know, I have a really hard time when she calls me on the phone, my sister, and she's talking about not being able to eat and you know, she's losing weight. When I saw her last October, she had lost so much weight, and she looked like olive oil from the Popeye cartoon thing. She had little skinny arms, you know, and legs. She was so thin. Now, since October, she told me she lost a lot of weight, and I'm thinking, from where? You know, there was nothing there to lose. But again, she wasn't eating, and when she was eating or taking her medicine, it made her sick, and so she's lost more weight. And I have to stop myself from saying, why don't you just eat? You know, go make some toast, put peanut butter on. You can have fat now. You can put butter on your toast. She's a diabetic. She had to watch her diet all these years. No, go ahead, have the whole milk in your cappuccino. You know, it's okay now. And she's having a hard time letting go of all those years of diabetic meals and things. But I have to just hold my tongue and not tell her what to do, because she doesn't want to hear that. She knows that she should be eating more. She knows that she needs to put on some weight, but you know, it's hard for her. She just can't do it. So I have to really, really be careful about all of that. Do I have time to say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. So anyway, all these years in the program, it's been really good. And I think because of the step work that I've done working with other people, that it has given me the ability to, first of all, to meet my husband. And I met him at a meeting, and then he invited me to come speak, and that was right after my daughter graduated college. And I went to speak, and then a couple of minutes later, he invited me for a barbecue at his house, and then we started dating. And a few years later, we got married. I think it's about 3 years later. So anyway, I met him, and we got married, and had a lot of fun with his family and his extended family, and I helped take care of his mother when she was getting older, and all that. But the big thing is that when we were going to retire, we had it. There's one grandchild in Iowa. That there's no way on earth. I was going to say a bad word, Jane. I was going to say that there is no way on, you know, anything. But I would swear. But we had two grandchildren here. So, and he had some bizarre idea about, we could retire to Seattle or something. I said, are you kidding me? There's a fault line on that side of the country. And we're not living on the West Coast. And then some other place, West Des Moines. So we decided to look around here because we had the two little grandchildren, and they were tiny. I mean, the first one was only a year old when the second one was born, but we started looking right after Sarah Mae was born, and we didn't want to live, you know, in the same neighborhood as them, but somewhere close by, so we moved down here. And it's delightful to, you know, take my granddaughter, who is now six, and she likes sparkle and glitz and bracelets and, you know, all this stuff. Her mother wore soccer shorts and a t-shirt for 4 years of high school. She never liked glitz. But it's fun to have that. But really, really making amends on a, maybe not a daily, but a weekly basis to my daughter, because our relationship was not good on that day when she told me that I really need to stop drinking because it has changed everything between us, and she didn't like it. So I've had to really, do what I could to make that relationship better. And I think that I'm doing pretty good at it. So, I tried, but it's just one of the blessings of the program. And, you know, I still, every day, I get up in the morning and I read my meditation, and I get down on my knees and I say the prayers from page 85 or 86 in the big book on awakening. And I take a copy of that when I go on trips, same thing. And, you know, it just, I really feel like God has worked in great ways in my life. So that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce.